This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Grave's a Fine and Private Place by Alan Bradley, read for you by Jane Entwistle. To Shirley, my inspiration. The grave's a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace. Andrew Marvell, to his coy mistress, 1681. Chapter 1. I am on my deathbed, again. Although I have done everything in my power to survive, it has not been enough. A human being can only bear so much. I turn my face to the wall in bitter remembrance. Father had died suddenly at Christmas, leaving a colossal vacuum which we quickly realized would never, could never, be filled. In some strange way, he had been the secret glue which held us all together, and with his passing, my sisters and I, never friends at the best of times, had now, and quite inexplicably, become the most deadly of mortal enemies, each of us wanting desperately to be in charge, to gain some control over her shattered life, found herself at odds with the others at every turn. Words and crockery were thrown with equal carelessness. It didn't seem to matter much who was hit. With our family on the verge of breaking up, Aunt Felicity had come down from London to sort us out, or so she claimed. In case we had forgotten it, we were quickly reminded of the fact that our dear auntie was, as the Book of Common Prayer so charitably puts it, a woman who followed the devices and desires of her own heart. In short, she was at best a stubborn old woman, and at worst, a bully and a tyrant. Buckshaw was to be sold at once, Aunt Felicity insisted, even though in law it was mine to do with as I pleased. Feely was to be married off to her fiancé, Dieter Schrantz, with all haste, or at least as quickly as possible, as soon as a respectable period of mourning had been observed. Daffy would be sent up to Oxford to read English. "Who knows but that, given time, you might even become a gifted teacher," Aunt Felicity had said, upon which Daffy had thrown her teacup and saucer into the fireplace and stormed out of the room. Tantrums were useless, Aunt Felicity had told us icily. Tantrums solve no problems, but only create new ones. As for me, I was to be taken up to London, along with my cousin Undine, to live with Aunt Felicity until she could decide what to do with us. In my case, I knew that meant sending me somewhere to continue those studies which had been interrupted when I was chucked out of Miss Bodicote's female academy in Canada. But what of Dogger and Mrs. Mullet? What would become of them?
They shall be paid off, and each given a small pension in proportion to their years of service, Aunt Felicity had decreed, and I'm sure they will both be very grateful.
Dogger fobbed off with a pension? It was unthinkable. Dogger had given us almost his entire life, first to my father, then to my mother, and later to my sisters and myself. I pictured him sitting on a quaint wooden bench by a river somewhere, dressed in a rough-spun pensioner's jacket, forced to beg bread from the passing tourists who took occasional snapshots of him to send home to their cretinous relatives. Dogger deserved better than that. And Mrs. Mullet? Left to cook for total strangers, she would languish and die, and we would be responsible. Our lives were looking exceedingly grim. Then, at the beginning of February, to make matters worse, King George had died. King George the Sixth, that lovely man who once sat and chatted so happily with me in our drawing-room, as if I were his own daughter. And with his passing, the entire nation, indeed all of the Commonwealth countries, perhaps even the whole world, joined in the shock and sadness of our own recent bereavement. And what of me? What of Flavia Deluce? I would perish, I decided. rather than submit to a lifetime locked in some dismal pigeon-infested London square, with an aunt who valued the Union Jack more than her own blood, I would simply do away with myself. And as an authority on poisons, I knew precisely how to accomplish it. No cyanide for me, thank you. I knew the symptoms all too well. The vertigo, the dizziness, the burning in the throat and stomach, and, as the vagus nerve becomes paralyzed, the difficulty in breathing, the cold sweat, the feeble pulse, the muscular paralysis, the crushing heaviness of the heart, the slobbering. I think it was the slobbering, more than anything, that put me off the cyanide. What self-respecting young woman would want to be found dead in her bedroom, drowned in her own drool? There were easier ways of joining the heavenly choir. And so, here I am on my deathbed, all warm and cozy, my half-closed eyes moving slowly for the last time across that ghastly, red-clotted, mustard-yellow wallpaper. I shall simply fall asleep, and they will never find so much as a trace of what it was that did me in. How clever of me to have hit upon it. They'll be sorry, I thought. They'll all be sorry. But no, I mustn't let it end like that. Mustn't let it end with such a commonplace expression. That was the kind of platitude milkmaids died with, or match girls. The death of Flavia Deluce demanded something greater, some great and noble words to hold in my mind as I stepped across the threshold of the universe. But what were they to be? Religion had been done to death. Perhaps I could conjure up some great insight into the peculiar electron bonding of diborane, B2H6, for instance, or the as-yet-unsolved atomic valences of Zeiss's salt. Yes, that was it. Paradise would welcome me. "Well done, Deluce," the vast crystal angels would say, flickering with frozen fire as I set foot upon their doorstep. I hugged myself, cuddling in my own warmth. How comfortable death was when properly done.
"Miss Flavia," Dogger said, breaking in upon my pleasant thoughts.
He had stopped rowing the skiff for a few moments and was pointing. I snapped out of my reverie in a split second. If it had been anyone but Dogger, I'd have taken my sweet time about it.
"That's Volsthorpe over there," he said, pointing. "St. Mildred's is just to the left of the tallest elm."
He knew I wouldn't want to miss it. St. Mildred's in the Marsh, where Canon Whitbread, the notorious poisoning parson, had just 2 years ago dispatched several of his female parishioners by lacing their communion wine with cyanide. It had been done for love, of course. Poison and passion, I have discovered, are as closely connected as Laurel and Hardy. "Looks a harmless enough place," I said, "like something from the pages of picturesque England."
"Yes," Dogger said, "such places often do. Horrific crimes can sometimes bleed a location of all feeling."
He fell into silence as he gazed across the water, and I knew he was thinking of the Japanese prisoner of war camp in which he and father had been so badly abused. As I have said, father's death, 6 months ago, was the reason we were now adrift on the river, my sisters, Ophelia and Daphne, and of course me, Flavia. Undine, as originally planned, had already gone up to London with Aunt Felicity. In the bow, her face damp with mosquito repellent, Feely lay languishing on a couple of striped pillows, staring down at her own reflection in the still water just ahead of our punt. She had not spoken since we set out this morning. The fingers of her right hand hammered out a tune on the gunwales, one of Mendelssohn's Songs Without Words. I recognized it by the rhythm, but her face was a perfect blank. On the raised wicker seat, Daffy sat hunched over a book, Robert Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy, a
oblivious to the glorious English landscape sliding slowly by on either side. Father's sudden and unexpected death had knocked our family into a kind of coma, brought on, I believe, by the fact that we Deluces are constitutionally incapable of expressing our grief. Only Dogger had broken down, howling like a dog in the night, then silent and impassive in the long and tortured days that followed. It was pitiful. The funeral had been a shambles. Denwin Richardson, the vicar and one of Father's oldest and dearest friends, had been seized at the outset by uncontrollable sobbing, unable to continue, and the service had to be halted until a stopgap clergyman could be found. In the end, poor old Canon Walpole was located in the next village, dragged from his sickbed and rushed to St. Tancred's, where he finished what his colleague had begun, barking from a rattling chest cold at the graveside like 100 hounds. It was a nightmare. Bent on taking charge, Aunt Felicity had, as I have said, swooped down from London, the death of her only and younger brother, having driven her into a frenzy, during which she treated us all like particularly dim-witted galley-slaves, slinging orders about like a grill-cook. "Straighten those magazines, Flavia. Put them in alphabetical and then in chronological order, right side up, in the cupboard. This is a drawing-room, not a jackdaw's nest. Ophelia, fetch a mop and pull down those spider's webs. The place is like a tomb." Then, realizing what she had said, she went all fretful with suppressed shame and made even more hurtful remarks, which I will not report here for fear of her reading them some day and taking revenge. Am I over-dramatizing the situation? Not entirely. You look like a school of slugs, Aunt Felicity had told us. You need something to burn away the slime. And so it was decided, I'm still not entirely sure by whom, that we all of us needed a holiday, something with sharabangs and gaily striped deck chairs by the sea, or at least exposure to the great outdoors. It was Dogger, I think, who had come up with the idea of a boat trip, of lazy days on the river, of cold meat hampers with flasks of lemonade and ginger beer from Fortnum and Mason, of goose-down mattresses at night, and hot beef roasts in an ever-changing string of country hotels. "Think of Huckleberry Finn," Daffy had said. "Who knows, Flavia, you might even be fortunate enough to find a dead body in a floating house." It seemed unlikely, but anything was better than staying at Buckshaw, which now seemed likely to remain in mourning until the last day of the last month of the end of time. There now seemed to be a sudden damp dustiness about the house that I had never noticed before. A certain staleness of the air, as if the ashes of generations of Deluces had been shaken from the bag of a Hoover and allowed to settle wherever they wished. In fact, it was Daffy who had pointed this out to me. "It's like the mouldy little church in the park in Bleak House," she had said with a shiver, pulling her cardigan closer about her shoulders, and referring to the book which she claimed to have been reading obsessively again and again since she was in a pram, beginning anew each time she finished. "There is a general smell and taste as of the ancient deadlocks in their graves. Gack." The gack was Daffy's, not in Dickens's original. Feely's marriage to Dieter Schrantz, which had been planned for June, was postponed out of respect to Father. There had been scenes of dinnerware thrown, wallpaper ripped, upholstery gutted, and so forth, but all of it had been in vain. "For the death of a parent, a heavy mourning period of 6 months is laid on," Aunt Felicity said, betraying her military attachments, no matter how top-secret they were supposed to have been. "And not a day less, and all your shrieking cuts no ice with me." And that was that. What should have been a time of bliss now became a nightmare, as Feely's nerves, fear and anger, seized reason by the throat and shook it dead. The result was a spectacular series of split-ups and reconciliations with Dieter, followed by suddenly renewed outbreaks of hostility that would have put even Genghis Khan to shame. Through it all, Dieter had been a brick, but had at last, as all heroes must sooner or later do, retired to lick his wounds. And so it came to pass that we had packed up with little ado, except on the part of Dogger, who was never ill-prepared, and set out on what was hoped would be a time of healing. But things didn't turn out that way. By the time we were finally able to make our first escape from Buckshaw, Father had been dead for nearly 6 months, during which it had seemed, at least in the beginning, as if Dogger had lost some essential part of his soul. But as the days went on, it became ever more apparent, to me anyway, that he was gaining something greater. In the past several weeks especially, Dogger had been acquiring a glow. It's hard to describe, but I'll do my best. It was not a superficial effect, as if he had just shaved and patted his face with a bay rum lotion, for Dogger would never stoop to such artifice. No, it was as if he had begun to grow a nimbus, that pale radiance which, in paintings of the medieval saints, is portrayed as a gold halo about the head, as if the saint in question were wearing an inverted brass kettle. There are, in fact, no halos in the Bible, just as there are no cats or accordions. If it's halos you're after, you'll have to look them up in the Encyclopaedia Britannica, where they come between hallucination and halogens. Physical halos, such as those observed around the moon or sun, are caused, as everybody knows, by the reflection and refraction of light by ice crystals suspended in the atmosphere. But for the halos of saints, no cause is given, although one can easily imagine. At least I can. In Dogger's case, it was a kind of glow, or glory, which was coming upon him only gradually. I had made a point of going into the kitchen first thing every morning to observe him closely, although I was, of course, discreet about it. There was a rather growing pinkness of the cheeks, and I had worried at first about stramonium poisoning, or plague. But since Dogger knew better than to handle the potted datura plant, datura stramonium, that grew in my chemical laboratory, and because the Black Death had been extinct in England since the last reported case near Ipswich had taken the life of a Mrs. Bug in 1918, I decided that Dogger's growing radiance could be only for the good. And so it was. On this particular morning in June, sitting dead centre in the skiff, digging the blades of the skulls firmly into the warm, muddy river water, Dogger was as handsome and as healthy as I had ever seen him. Like a cinema star, in fact. If this were a film rather than real life, he would be played, perhaps, by John Mills, squinting knowingly with a slight smile into the morning sunshine, as if he saw already what lay just round the next bend. And perhaps he did. "Have you ever been here before, Dogger?" I asked. "On this particular stretch of the river, I mean."
"Many years ago, Miss Flavia," he answered, "but that was in another life."
And I knew enough to leave it at that. I gazed across the water at the rich and comforting shades of the churchyard. Most people probably never stop to think about why our burial places are so green, but if they ever did, their faces might turn the very shade of that graveyard grass, for underneath the picturesque moss and lichen, and beneath all those weathered stones, is a slowly simmering chemical stew, bubbling and burbling away in the dark earth, as our ancestors and neighbours, with the help of a little chemistry, are returned to their Maker. "For dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return," the Bible tells us. "Ashes to ashes, dust to dust," says the Book of Common Prayer. But both of these books, having been written mostly in good taste,
failed to mention either the stinking jelly or the oozing liquids and the gaseous phases through which each of us must pass on our way to the great beyond. The average churchyard is a first-rate meat tenderizer. Shocking, perhaps, but true. In an issue of the Illustrated London News from several years ago, which I found abandoned under a sofa in the drawing room at Buckshaw, it was reported that an extract of the humble papaya fruit was now being marketed to soften the squire's steak. What a colossal waste, I had thought. A faster and much more powerful and effective product could be easily manufactured simply by bottling. By now, we were drifting along just feet from the edge of the churchyard, and St. Mildred's in the Marsh loomed above us, the shadow of its square tower blocking the morning sun. A sudden chill came into the air, and it wasn't just from the light wind which had suddenly sprung up, signalling a change in the weather. "It was just there by the old dock, wasn't it, Dogger, that Canon Whitbread chucked the poisoned chalice into the river?" I knew perfectly well that it was. I had pored for ages over the photographs and news of the world, memorizing the details, the path, the dock, the sloping river bank, the reeds, all helpfully labelled with arrows for the convenience of the bloodthirsty reader. He had thrown the vessel into the river in the belief that it would sink to the bottom and remain there in the mud until Judgment Day. He hadn't counted, however, upon the villainy of some earlier churchwarden who had replaced the original silver with a thinly plated alloy replica which, unfortunately, floated and remained bobbing among the reeds for a farmer's boy to find. "He oughtn't to have dumped it on a moonless night," I said aloud.
"Just so, Miss Flavia," Dogger said, easily able to read my thoughts. "He might have seen that it hadn't sunk."
"It might have, though," I said excitedly. "It could have been brought back up by some punter's pole or a heavy oar."
"Could have," Dogger said, "but not likely. I believe the police rejected that theory on the grounds of fragility. The rather frail replica would almost certainly have been dented by such an instrument, but it was not."
"Odd, then," I said, "that Canon Whitbread had never noticed the lightness of the substitute chalice."
"Unless it was he himself who swapped it," Dogger said.
I slapped the surface of the water in excitement, my heart thrilling at the idea that it was here, at this very spot, that the traces of cyanide and strychnine had been washed away. Perhaps some of the molecules still remained, vastly diluted, of course. But still, if the homeopathic theories of Samuel Hahnemann were to be believed, deadly effective.
"Flavia!" Daffy shouted. "You flaming idiot! You've soaked my book!"
Daffy's magnificent vocabulary always failed her when she was genuinely angry. She slammed the volume shut and jammed it into the wicker picnic basket. There was a blessed but slightly tense silence along the river now, as we drifted beneath the arches of the willows. Now and then the glassy surface would be broken by a fish's bubbles. "Do fish break wind?" I idly wondered. We were not far from one of the great universities. Surely someone there would know. Some famous scientist. Some ichthyologist, to be precise. Some young, up-and-coming ichthyologist, with a square jaw and curly blonde hair, a pipe and blue eyes. I could drop in to consult with him about some rarefied chemical question, one that would make him realize instantly that I was no rank amateur. The dispersal of cyanide and strychnine in riverine fish habitats. Yes, that was it. Roger, his name would be. Roger de something or other, to suit my own, from an ancient Norman family, with enough arms, crests, flags, banners and blazons to shame a second-hand automobile mart. "Roger," I would say. No, wait. Roger was too commonplace. Something you might call a dog. His name needed to be Llewellyn, pronounced the proper way. Llewellyn, the way they do in Wales. Yes, Llewellyn. Llewellyn, I would say, if ever you have a case of piscine poisoning to solve, I should be happy to help. Or was that too forward?
I had never actually performed an autopsy on a fish, but it couldn't be all that different from dissecting bloaters at the breakfast table.
I sighed with pleasure and let my hand dangle languidly over the side.
Something touched it. Something grazed against my fingers, and I instinctively made a grab. Was it a fish? Could I possibly have caught a fish by hand? Had some dim-witted chub or stupid pike mistaken my trailing fingers for a bit of floating food? Not wanting to lose the opportunity to go down in history as fish-hook Flavia, I hung on for dear life, hooking my fingertips firmly behind the hard ridge of bone I could now so easily feel. I planted my thumb for a firmer grip. This catch was not going to become the one that got away.
"Hold on, Dogger," I said, trying to keep my voice level and matter-of-fact. This story was going to be handed down for generations, and I wanted to make sure that my cool-headedness was properly noted. "I believe I've caught something."
Dogger stopped rowing and let the skiff drift. I could feel the dead weight of the thing dragging at my arm. It must be one of those gigantic fish, famous in local lore, that lives for centuries at the bottom of a pool. Old Mouldy or some such name, the villagers would call it. Would they be outraged to hear that I had caught their beloved monster with my bare hands? I smiled at the thought. Whatever it wasn't putting up much of a fight. Although Daffy and Feely were pretending to be disinterested, both had turned toward me. Holding on with all my strength, I gave my extended arm a good shake, taking care not to let go of my prey, whatever it might be. I had seen photographs in the picture magazines of the American author Mr. Hemingway battling a giant marlin on the end of a ridiculously slender pole. Even he, I'll bet, had never landed such a fish by hand.
"Flavia," I thought, "you're about to become famous."
As the boat slowed and the water cleared, a shadow, and then a brighter patch, appeared just beneath the surface. A fish's belly? It was certainly light enough. I hauled it in for closer inspection. Although the object was upside down, it was now easily recognizable. It was a human head, and attached to it was a human body. My fingers were inserted firmly in the corpse's open mouth, locked behind its upper teeth.
"We'd best make for the pier, Dogger," I said.
Chapter 2. Bringing the skiff alongside the pier behind the church was not so easy a task as it might have been. For one thing, Daffy was busily disposing, over the gunwales, of every bite she had eaten since last Thursday fortnight. If you've ever seen those cinema newsreels in which a trawler dumps its nets, you'll know what I'm talking about. To say that her gorge was rising would be a gross understatement. Hurling her guts out was more like it. To be honest, it was awe-inspiring. If it hadn't been for the seriousness of the situation, it might even have been amusing. Dogger, to his great credit, said not a word. A single glance over his shoulder told him all he needed to know, and he reacted accordingly. Slowly but steadily we edged in silence, except for Daffy's retching, of course, toward the river bank. Nearby boaters, of whom there were several, would assume that a young lady had been taken ill. Paste sandwiches that had gone over, perhaps, or a bit of bad tongue. It would not do to stare, and no one did. None of them could see, of course, what I was dragging by its open mouth. As the skiff bumped against the wooden dock, Dogger handed me the tartan picnic blanket we had intended to sit upon for tea. I knew at once what he wanted me to do, and I did it. Without attracting attention, I took the blanket with my left hand, unfolded it, and spread it casually over the floating corpse. Having made fast the skiff, Dogger stepped out into the shallow water, took hold of the shrouded figure, lifted it gently in his arms, and waded to the grassy bank beside the pier. In another moment he had laid the body in the grass at the edge of the churchyard. I couldn't help noticing the bruise on the back of the neck, as if the man had somehow stumbled, banged his head, and fallen into the water. Dead men don't bruise, I remembered.
"Artificial respiration?" I asked, trying to think logically. Dogger had once told me of his studies in the Kano system of jiu-jitsu, in which drowning victims had been restored to life by a sharp blow across the soles of the feet.
"I'm afraid not, miss," Dogger said, lifting a corner of the blanket. "It's too late for that. The fish have already been at this poor fellow."
And he was right. The earlobes and the nose had certainly been nibbled. As for the rest of the face, the dead man had been handsome enough. Those long, lank red locks, now plastered down by the wet, must once have curled fetchingly enough about the lace collar of his ruffled silk shirt.
I am not making this up. It really was silk, as were the blue trousers, which were fastened by buttons and silken ribbons at the knee.
I had the strange impression that I was looking at someone from the 18th century, some time-traveller who had slipped playfully beneath the surface of the water in the days of King George III, perhaps, and decided just now that enough was enough. My next thought was this. Had anyone gone missing from a masquerade, or from the cast of a cinema film? Surely such a thing would have been widely reported. And yet, here was this healthy young specimen, aside from being dead, of course, laid out like a trout on the river bank, as if it were the most natural thing in all the world. He was almost too beautiful, like the blue boy of Gainsborough's famous painting, but rather more pale. But wait, it was a painting he reminded me of, yet it certainly wasn't a Gainsborough. No, it was a work by a much less well-known artist named Henry Wallace. The Death of Chatterton, it was called, and it depicted the body of that sad young poet who had poisoned himself in 1770 at the age of 17, having been exposed as a literary forger. I ought to have realized this at once, but I didn't, even though a large framed reproduction of the original had been hanging for years in a place of honor on my bedroom wall. It is one of my favorite works of art, I must admit. In the painting, Chatterton, his flesh an awful fish belly white, lies stretched upon a shabby couch in his rented garret, the fingers of his left hand seeming to bear the breast in which his heart had quite recently been beating. His right hand lies stiffly clutched on the floor near the empty arsenic bottle. All art ought to be this fascinating.
"Please remain where you are, Miss Ophelia and Miss Daphne," Dogger said, pulling me out of my thoughts. "Keep a sharp eye out, both up and down the river."
What a clever man, I thought. He meant to keep them occupied, keep them from going into hysterics, keep them from trampling the evidence. It is a remarkable fact that orders given in a firm voice at the scene of a tragedy are invariably obeyed.
"If you be good enough to stay here, Miss Flavia," he said, "I shall go for the police."
I gave him a brisk nod and he was off, scrambling up the grassy riverbank toward the church, the wet turnips of his trousers sloshing round his ankles, but still dignified in spite of it. As soon as he was gone, I lifted the corner of the blanket. The pale blue eyes, which were half open, the pupils dilated, gazed up at me in surprise, as if I had suddenly snatched a coverlet from the face of a light sleeper. The irises matched the colour of his lips and the silk ribbons at his knees. I sniffed the lips, actually touched them with the tip of my nose, but could detect nothing but the brackish smell of river water. I leaned low over the corpse and drew up into my nostrils the smell of his eyeballs. I was already half expecting it. The odour of apples. Potassium cyanide, I recalled, is quite odourless until mixed with water, in which it freely dissolves to form an alkaline solution from which prussic acid is abundantly evolved, which, when exposed to air, volatilizes to produce the smell of apples. The tissue of the eyes, being the thinnest and softest in the body, not only are more absorbent of chemical odours than are other parts of the body, but retain them longer. If you don't believe me, take a whiff of your own tears an hour after you've eaten onions. Also the eyes, having been fixed in a half-closed position, would have been better protected from the diluting effect of the water than the nose and lips. His complexion was, well, let's just say that it was interesting. Although the features were somewhat bloated, there was remarkably little lividity. A sure sign, I remembered, either that the body had not been in the water for long, or that it had been sunken in the cooler depths for several days. The fact that it had now floated up to the surface, though, was a likely indication of gaseous putrefaction. There were other possibilities, of course, but that was the most likely sequence of events. Further physical signs, which I could have checked, might also be present, but examining these would have involved stripping the body, which, I decided, would not be decent. Besides, there wasn't time. Dogger would be returning with the police at any moment. In drowning, it is sometimes the internal evidence which turns out to be most crucial. Obviously, I couldn't conduct a full-scale post-mortem here on the river bank. I would have to settle for the next best thing. Placing both hands in an overlapping position on the dead man's chest, I threw all my weight into a powerful, straight-armed push. I was amply rewarded. A surprisingly rich flow of frothy broth, followed by what I took to be water, streamed out from between his bluish lips. Reaching for my handkerchief, I blotted up the mess, folded it inward in a ball to avoid contamination, and returned it to my pocket. Certain people, such as Mrs. Mullet, for instance, kept going on about the importance of always carrying a clean handkerchief about one's person, and for once they were right. A quick look round told me that I had not been observed. Returning to my physical examination of the corpse, I felt the palms of the dead man's hands for looseness of skin, the glove effect, which would indicate a longer immersion in the water, but they were remarkably firm. Almost without thinking, I raised my fingertips to my nose. It's remarkable, really, how much we ignore our sense of smell. Until, that is, we detect one extreme or another, fragrant or foul, either roses or rot. The human olfactory system has trained itself to ignore anything that doesn't matter. I sniffed my fingers. Aha! I hadn't really expected anything out of the ordinary, but my nose was picking up an unmistakable smell. Peraldehyde, by all that's holy! Good old, jolly old CH3CHO trimer. A foul-smelling, foul-tasting, but colourless liquid which can be easily produced by treating aldehyde with sulfuric or hydrochloric acid. The stuff was first synthesized in 1829, and had once been combined with extract of vanilla, syrup of raspberries, and chloroform to treat insomnia. It had also been used, mixed with equal parts of cherry laurel water, to administer subcutaneous injections to the insane. But because of the lingering reek of the breath it produced in the patient, peraldehyde had generally been abandoned 100 years ago. Although I had overheard someone remark that there were still those, particularly among the aristocracy, who had gone beyond alcohol and become addicted to the stuff. I sniffed my fingertips again to reinforce my memory of the facts. Peraldehyde poisoning, if I recalled correctly, contracted the pupils, whereas this poor man's were dilated. It didn't quite add up. There wasn't that sudden click of certainty. It would have to wait until later. There was no time now. I returned my attention to the lower parts of the body. On one of the feet, which stuck out slightly beyond the far end of the blanket, was what I can only describe as a red ballet slipper. The other foot was bare. He was not a tall man, I judged, somewhat less than 5.5 feet, perhaps, although it was difficult to estimate with him lying on his back and partly covered. Yes, that was it. The man was a ballet dancer, which would account for his costume. I was proud of myself. He had come down to the river bank in the night, perhaps to practice his pirouettes away from prying eyes. Swan Lake, probably. What a sight that must have been, beneath the weeping willows and the sleepily flowing river, until he had misjudged, or tripped, and fallen into the dark water. Or been pushed. Had he become entangled in reeds or duckweed? I folded back more of the blanket. There was no vegetation clinging to his body. Perhaps some of it had become caught up in his clothing. I decided to search him. Have you ever stuck your hands into the pockets of a corpse? Perhaps not. I myself have done it on only a couple of occasions, and I can tell you that it's not always the most pleasant of occupations. Who knows what may be lurking in the crevices of the clothing? With a drowning victim, you're at risk of eels, water snakes, crabs, and so forth. And I tried to recall quickly which species of these, such as the Chinese mitten crab, had been known to make their way upstream from the tidal waters of the Thames. When it comes to crabs, you can never be too cautious. I needn't have worried. Except for a wad of wet lint and a folded bit of soggy blue-lined paper from his trousers, the corpse's pockets were empty. I fished out the paper between my first and second fingers, noting as I did so that I would need to give my hands a jolly good scrubbing later because of the slime. Smoothing it carefully with my thumb to avoid disintegration, I slowly unfolded the scrap. Something had been written upon it in pencil, a series of numbers. 54, 6, 7, 8, 9. A date, perhaps? The year 1954, with 6, 7, 8, and 9 representing the months of June, July, August, and September? If so, it was still some 2 years in the future, since we were now in June of 1952. People don't usually make appointments that far in advance. Or could it be the combination to a safety lock? That seemed unlikely, since a series of 4 small numbers in strict numerical sequence would be extremely difficult to dial accurately, if it could be done at all. As Dogger had taught me during one of our sessions devoted to the art of lock-picking, combinations generally contain at least 2 widely spaced numerals. Or was it a telephone number? I couldn't be sure which exchange was represented by the first 2 digits, but one could always ring the number and see who picked it up on the other end. The possibilities seemed endless, which made it all the more exciting, since possibilities are so much more thrilling than certainties, or so I've always thought. I was about to stuff the wadded paper back into the corpse's pocket, when a sudden shadow blocked the sun and fell upon the body. An electric chill shot through my bones. I twisted round and put my hand up to block the light, but could see only a black silhouette hovering over my shoulder. "What are you doing to Orlando?" demanded a voice, and I nearly leapt out of my liver. The speaker was seated in an antique wicker bath chair, and had rolled up in such silence that I hadn't heard her coming. "What are you playing at? Is this a game? Another one of your larks? Get up at once, Orlando. You're soiling your silks.
I'm sorry, I said, scrambling to my feet. I'm afraid.
And well, you might be, you shameless girl. What are you playing at? Answer me at once.
My first impression of the woman was that she had a beak like a battleship, forward-jutting and powerful enough to slice through the most fearsome Atlantic breakers as if they were runny cheese. Her snow-white hair was tied up so tightly into a large bun at the back of her head that it gave her face the appearance of a squeezed pimple in the instant before it bursts. The toe of a riding boot peeked out from under a lap robe, and an old school tie flopped out of a Norfolk jacket onto her ample chest. The woman seemed all odds and ends.
"What are you staring at?" she asked. "Didn't your parents teach you not to gawk?"
"That did it. My parents, both of them now deceased, God rest their dear departed souls, had taught me the most important thing of all, which was to show some spine in the face of bullying. I know that I ought to have been a fountain of condolences, a rock of sympathy in a sea of sadness, but this woman had stepped across my line of decency. I couldn't bring myself to touch her, let alone hug her.
Orlando is dead, I informed her. He drowned. We found the body.
I could tell she was not listening to me.
Orlando, get up at once, she commanded. The Hawthorne Wests will be arriving in an hour, and you know how Parthia hates to be kept waiting.
Orlando's already pallid complexion was tinted an even more awful green by the closeness of the grass, and I couldn't help noticing that a couple of dandelions beside his ears were reflecting little yellow bruises onto his cheeks, like dabs of rancid butter.
"That's enough, Orlando," the woman said, releasing a foot from its stirrup beneath the lap robe and giving his shoulder a prod. "Get up now and come along."
I seized her arm.
"Better not touch him," I said. "He's dead. The police have been called."
The woman looked up at me, then back at the corpse, then back at me again. Her eyes widened, and her vast and lightly whiskered upper lip curled back as a horrible wail shattered the quiet air, rising and falling like a demented air raid siren. Her ear-splitting screech caused Feely and Daffy to swivel their heads in our direction, but only for a quick glance, returning at once to scouting the river, as Dogger had instructed them to do. "See no evil, hear no evil," was their motto, and some small part of me didn't blame them. Being embroiled with bodies is not so simple as some people seem to think it is. Looking away is easy, but staring death in the face takes more than a strong stomach. Dogger, I saw, was now returning through the churchyard, accompanied by two other persons. One, it was obvious by his uniform, was a village constable, the other, by his dog collar, the vicar, a roly-poly, jolly-looking gentleman. Thank heavens, I thought, I would no longer have to deal with this howling harpy on my own.
"Stand back, please," the constable said, as I knew he would.
I was happy to obey by getting to my feet and shuffling backward to a point where I could watch without being watched. Of such small tools from one's bag of tricks are great investigators made. I know how stuffy that must sound, but it's true. Dogger and I stood looking on as the constable, gingerly, I thought, peered under the corner of the blanket. Having satisfied himself that he was dealing with a dead body, he tugged at his jacket, straightened his tie, turned to us and said,
"Yes, well then."
He jabbed his thumb vaguely toward the church, and presumably the high street.
"I'd be obliged if you'd all step across to the Oaken Pheasant. The landlord lays on a good spread of pickled hocks and cheese, if you feel up to it, that is. I shall be along in due course."
If we felt up to it? I suppose he meant to sound solicitous. Or was it supposed to be humorous? Whose leg did this village idiot think he was pulling? I had half a mind to tell him that there was nothing I loved more than gorging on cold ham while examining a particularly juicy corpse. I caught Dogger's eye before I replied.
"That's very thoughtful of you, Constable," I said. "I think I could stand a whiff of smelling salts about now."
Because it was expected of a girl my age, I flashed him a quick but slightly sickly grin, leaving him to work out what I meant.
"Have we seen everything that we need to?" I asked Dogger from the corner of my mouth, as we walked to fetch Feely and Daffy from the punt.
"We have indeed, Miss Flavia," he said, "more than enough."
Chapter 3
"How perfectly icky!" Daffy whined when we were seated round a table in the saloon bar of the Oak and Pheasant.
I hadn't the faintest idea whether she was referring to the pub, the corpse, or the wailing woman in the bath chair we had left to the tender mercies of the constable on the river bank. Nor did I particularly care. Feely shifted uneasily in her chair, giving quick, darting glances round the room. I knew at once that she was unable to hide her discomfort at being seated with a servant. I don't know what she was worried about. The only other patrons in the pub were a group of rather shabby men of assorted sizes, all wearing coloured kerchiefs round their necks, all busily poking one another in the chest and laughing loudly at the other's jokes. Not that Dogger would have minded. We were on holiday, and so was he. Rank and station were forgotten, or were supposed to be. Things were different since the war. Feely had been brought up in a different world, and it showed. I pitied my sister. Her life had not been an easy one, especially recently. She was mourning father and moping over her postponed marriage. To someone used to getting her own way, it must have seemed like the apocalypse.
"What'll it be?" the landlord asked, his pencil poised. "Ploughman's lunch all round."
In his apron and shirt sleeves, he was a very picture of an innkeeper in a cartoon from Punch.
"A pint of Guinness, please," Feely said, and I nearly fell out of my chair. It was the first time she had spoken since breakfast.
"Are you over 18?" the landlord asked. "Sorry, miss, but I'm obliged to inquire." "I can vouch for her," Dogger said.
"I'll have the same," Daffy blurted, and the man was too taken aback to repeat his question.
She was evidently even more shaken than I had thought.
"Ginger beer for me," I said, "and if it's not too much trouble, I'd like it warmed on the back of the cooker for 3 minutes."
It's always a good idea to demand some quirky service, to let them know that you're not just anybody. I knew that with an investigation getting underway over against the churchyard wall, we were bound to be in this village for quite some time, and it was essential to establish priorities at the outset. You can't command respect after the starting whistle's been blown, especially among strangers. The landlord gave me a squinty eye, but he wrote down my order.
"And you, sir?" he asked, turning to Dogger.
"Milk," Dogger replied.
"A small glass of milk. It's pasteurized, I presume."
"Pasteurized and pasteurized, sir," the landlord laughed, slapping his knee. I could have slapped his face.
"You've never seen milk so pasteurized as our own. Why, just yesterday I was saying to Mr. Clem, our vicar, you'll get no trade from our kitchen, meaning, of course, in the funeral department. He wasn't amused, like Queen What's-Her-Name."
I stopped listening. I knew all too well the dangers of unpasteurized milk. The chemist, Louis Pasteur, was, after all, one of my great heroes. I had eagerly memorized the symptoms of tuberculosis, also known as consumption or phthisis, and how the bacillus responsible caused the victim's lungs to turn into a kind of weeping cheese.
the features becoming livid and darkening as the blood retains excessive carbon, the hectic fevers, the racking cough, the racing pulse, the wasting muscles, the night sweats and the agitated delirium. The mind, however, remaining cruelly clear and focused almost until the very end. There had been a time when, after first reading up on these horrors, I had refused to drink so much as a drop of milk without first taking it to my chemical laboratory and pasteurizing it personally, then examining it closely under the microscope for rogue bacilli. Nowadays, of course, since the discovery of penicillin in 1928 by Alexander Fleming, no one dies of consumption, except in the cinema, where its onset is invariably signalled by tragic glances, sprayed on perspiration, soot rubbed below the eyes, dramatic coughing and spitting of fake blood always, conveniently, into spotlessly white handkerchiefs. My fascinating train of thought was interrupted by the arrival of our drinks.
"Cheers," Daffy said quietly, raising her glass to each of us in turn.
She was showing off, not giving a thought to the seriousness of the situation. Even if taste and decency are chucked out the window, there is one rule that remains, keeping a long face in the presence of death. I shot her a wet blanket look.
"Sorry," she said, surprisingly humbled.
In the silence that followed, I let my mind drift across the room, out the door, across the road, and through the churchyard to the river bank. Who was the dead man, and how had he come to drown? Had it been an accident, or—
"I want to go home," Feely said suddenly. "I'm not feeling well. I've had enough."
Oddly enough, I knew exactly what she meant. It wasn't just the finding of a corpse on the river. As I have said, Father's death had told terribly upon her, and the continued postponements of her wedding date and the resulting battles even more. Poor Feely, I thought. Her life had been a will-o'-the-wisp, with true happiness always just beyond her grasp. I had an idea, but it would keep until after we had eaten. I touched her arm as a kind of message-received signal. Was the look that she returned a grateful one? With Feely, one could never know. Dogger, as I knew he would, ordered the ploughman's lunch, Feely a small salad, and Daffy a small dish of steamed carrots.
"I'm sorry," she said, "but I simply can't face meat."
I plumped for plain old chutney, cheese, and pickled onions, a favourite dish which I had secretly named the embalmer's breakfast. It was as like a chemical lab as you could get when away from home. We ate in silence. The things that Dogger and I might have talked about were not suitable for my sister's ears, while the topics I might have discussed with them were unfit for his. As we were finishing our meal, the door of the public bar next door burst open, and a loud, breathless voice announced,
"Somebody's drowned! They fished a dead un out to the river!"
A general hubbub arose at once as chairs and boots grated noisily on the floor. Before you could say ninepins, the place had emptied, and the only sound was that of a few retreating voices.
"Come," I said, tugging at Feely's arm. It was time to put my plan into execution.
"I'm not going back there," she said. "I don't feel well. I want to go home."
"I know," I told her, not loosening my grip. "But think, what's across the road?"
"A drowned body," she answered, shuddering.
"Besides that," she looked up at me dumbly.
"A church," I said. "And where there's a church, there's an organ. No smoke without fire, and so forth. Come on, let's go. My ears are parched. I need a bit of bark."
Something dawned on Feely's face. It wasn't exactly happiness, but it would do. As she got to her feet, I took her forefinger and led her toward the door.
It was the first time I had willingly touched my sister's hand since I was 9 months old and learning to walk. Outside, the June weather was glorious, and we both had to shield our eyes against the summer sun. We crossed the road and approached the church along the gravel path. St. Mildred's in the Marsh. It's